This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, in the 1962 song Respect, recently crowned number one in Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Rolling Stone created the original list back in 2004. Now, for the first time in almost two decades, they've updated it, replacing more than half of the list with new songs. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, frequent guest here on Central Time on All Matters Musical. Alexander, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's nice to be back.
This was a big update. A lot of turnover in these songs. As you look and compare the list, what were some of the big trends in the kinds of songs that came in and went out?
Well, I think in terms of the songs that came in, obviously you had a lot of new songs from the last 15 years or so, and that's not surprising since a lot of great music has been produced over the last 15 years, and it makes sense that they would be included. And then it's not just the songs from the last 15 years, but it's arguably the songs from kind of 1980 and beyond, which gain a little bit more traction on this list than on the previous list. And that makes a lot of sense, too, when you consider that the voters who are choosing these songs is always changing, and you have a generation of writers, critics, artists, and industry folks who are all coming from a younger generation than before, and so they're going to be more interested in the music of their youth or the music of their young adulthood, or maybe not so young adulthood, but they're paying attention. And so that really changes some of the dynamic of the list, and that is great. That's part of what these ever-changing lists are all about. I think you see an increase in the amount of hip hop, although we can talk in a moment about this, perhaps not as much as there should be. And I think there's a change in the gender ratio of the list, that there are more women on the list and there are more women near the top of the list. And that is a welcome transformation of the list as well. So those are all those three are sort of the big changes that I see on the list. In terms of the omissions, well, not surprisingly, some of the older music that was on previous lists has fallen off. In particular, a lot of the songs of the 1950s, some of which were really, really big songs, are no longer on the list or have dropped precipitously on the list itself. And you even have quite a few big anthems from the 1960s that either dropped a lot on the list or came off of the list. So that is one significant change. You also have, in general, a little more R&B, certainly hip hop, towards the top of the list, and some of the big rock songs that were at the top falling further down the list as it has changed over the years.
We got a taste of the new number one, Respect by Aretha Franklin. I want to give a listen to the old number one. It dropped to number four. Here it is. So Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, dropped from number one to number four. If there was a cliche, Alexander, of a Rolling Stone number one song pick, I think Like a Rolling Stone would be it. I remember there was a parody issue of Rolling Stone where it was Bob Dylan on the cover with Like a Rolling Stone reference. I don't know. What do you think about that change from what I would consider sort of the old model Rolling Stone top list to this one?
Well, I think that the fact that you have three African-American artists at the top of the list is a recognition from the voters that African-American music is central to American music, that it is the foundation upon which all of this popular music is really built, R&B, soul, funk, rock and roll, hip hop, you name it. And I think that the change and the shift that you see on the list is attempting to acknowledge that in some way by putting these tremendous songs at the very top. Number four is no slouch for Bob Dylan, given especially that it came out in 1965. And I think that there has been a shift, certainly since the 1990s, in which, arguably even maybe a little earlier than that, in which rock and roll's central place in the story of American popular music has receded a little bit. And so my guess is that putting and having it end up at number four is something of a recognition of that transformation.
Talking to UW-Madison's Alexander Shashko, looking at the new list from Rolling Stone magazine, the 500 best songs ever, as voted by a lot of people in the industry, musicians, music writers, and more. Alexander, if you were going to start rating number one songs, like what criteria would you even start to do? I don't know how I would start. What would be at the top of your mind to try to pick and quantify the greatest songs?
Well, of course, it can't be quantified. So creating the numbers is always controversial by definition, since there's no true way to quantify this. But what I would say is that you'd want a song that caught people's attention when it happened. In other words, a song that has some kind of resonance in the moment that it was released, but also something that has stood the test of time, a song that continues to be resonant and popular over time. It's a song generally that is easily recognizable, something that folks don't forget, which is, of course, connected to it being resonant over time. You know, when you're starting to talk about elite songs at the very top, the music's got to be amazing and the lyrics have to be amazing. It really, one or the other is not going to cut it. And that's, I think, part of what unites all of the songs that are near the top of this list. And then, you know, the historical resonance is important too. Where is this song in terms of its deeper meaning in American society? And that's where the greatest part of this list comes in. And I do want to note that when the voters were asked to write these lists, they were asked to write their 50 favorite songs. And to me, that's a little bit different than talking about the greatest songs, and something does get lost in translation there. Now, I completely acknowledge that many of the voters may not have made that distinction in any meaningful way, but to talk about something that is your favorite is something that you particularly like or that you find, you know, sort of preferred over anything else, whereas something that is the greatest is something that you consider of sort of a quality or eminence that is above normal or above average. And I'm sure people kept that in mind as well, but I am a little curious about how the list turned out because folks were asked to list their favorite. And then the list was promoted as being the greatest. And, you know, maybe the greatest really should be just what people like the most. But the historian in me, and that's of course what I do, has some questions about that, because, you know, to be a historian and to be a historian of music is also to acknowledge why a song matters, not just whether I love it.
It's Brianna, caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I would say for criteria that it should, whatever the message is in the song should be more towards a timeless message, I feel personally. And because of that, I'd go with All Along the Watchtower, but Jimi Hendrix version, even though it was written by Dylan. And with the whole Dylan thing, I'm surprised that he didn't fall more, being that there's charges similar to, not as severe as the R. Kelly thing, but, you know, I wonder how much that's going to be taken into consideration, you know, moving forward for artists and stuff, too.
I'm not aware of the Dylan story, but a couple points there. First of all Along the Watchtower, the Jimi Hendrix version, cover of the Dylan written song, Alexander. I don't have the whole list in front of me because 500 songs, but I imagine right. A fair amount of people might put that up there.
Yeah, it's actually in the top 50. So it is, I think, right around 45 or 40 or something like that. And it is a tremendous song. I mean, it's a song, again, that has incredible historical relevance to the Vietnam era, and the fact that it is written by Dylan and, you know, performed by Hendrix obviously makes it all that more power, much more powerful. And in fact, if you think about a lot of the songs that are near the top or in the top 50, one thing that I noticed is that quite a few of them are building off of the work of more than one tremendous artist. So Aretha's Respect, you know, was written by Otis Redding. Fight the Power, Public Enemy, is built off of a lot of samples, including the Isley Brothers. You know, they're taking the title from the Isley Brothers, Fight the Power. Smells Like Teen Spirit is inspired by the Pixies. So there are a lot of ways in which these songs near the top kind of have a little extra energy to them because of the way in which they are building off of the foundation of something that's already pretty great. And I think that All Along the Watchtower certainly fits within that category.
Let's go now to Katie with us in Sturgeon Bay. Katie, hello.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Katie?
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, From the Beginning.
Yeah, so I got to say, I had the Trilogy album. I wore the grooves out of that on vinyl when I was a kid. Why does that song stand out for you, Katie?
It was such a tumultuous time. I was a teenager when that came out. And just questions, why are we here? You know, the Vietnam War, of course, it was winding down, but it was a soul-searching song.
Interesting. Katie, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Alexander, I think it's going to be true for a lot of people. If you ask us our favorite song, it's going to have a lot to do with where we were and when we were when we heard it.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're young, in many cases, the music that you're listening to is part of how you shape your identity, your own sense of self. It's connected to deep memories that you may have of family or first experiences. And that only, continues to happen throughout the rest of your life, even if it's not necessarily as profound as it is when you're young. So those personal experiences are absolutely part of what makes a song a favorite, right? What makes a song meaningful to any given person. And that's why this list changes, because as a different group of people are voting, almost no matter how much they're trying to think in terms of the broad sweep of history, their own personal biases, their own personal experiences are going to play into it. I mean, if they only ask you to pick 50 out of the 500, you're going to leave a lot of songs out that are important or even meaningful to you in an attempt to come up with a list. And that certainly is the experience I'm guessing that most of the voters had.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about Rolling Stone magazine's update to their 500 greatest songs of all time list. You can join in with your greatest song of all time at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share a song and why it's great to you. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Fight the Power there by Public Enemy, the number two song on Rolling Stone magazine's new list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison stays with us, and you can share your pick, whatever standard you want to use for your greatest of all time. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Franklin. Scott, hi.
Hi. I think a really good song that needs a nod here is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, having topped the charts at the time it was released, and then made it back up to number one again decades later because of its roles in some movies in the 90s.
Yeah, some staying power right there. And Scott, apart from the staying power, is it a personal favorite of yours?
It's definitely within my top 10.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing that up, Scott. The staying power, Alexander, it wasn't just a hit then, but it's something that came back maybe even for new generations.
Absolutely. And Bohemian Rhapsody's in the top 20. So I think that is confirmation of it. Yeah, exactly. That experience. The fact that the song has continued to emerge as a fan favorite time and time again means that different generations of listeners are experiencing it in a way that they find appealing, that they connect to in some meaningful way. And if you look at several of these songs near the top, certainly that is a similar kind of dynamic. Marvin Gaye's What's Going On is a song that continues to be resonant in terms of social movements. The same goes for Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come and Public Enemy's Fight the Power, for that matter. You also have a song like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams, which is in the top 10. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that song is particularly resonant right at this moment, that it has been viral on TikTok over the past year. Fleetwood Mac have been getting a lot of attention, and the song stands on its own. There's no question it would be a song that would be somewhere near the top regardless, but it undoubtedly has been helped by the fact that it was in the air at the moment. And sometimes songs like that gain in popularity because of the second, third, or fourth life that they live.
Thanks a lot for the call, Scott, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Amanda now in Green Bay. Amanda, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your song, Amanda?
Oh, it'd have to be Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel.
And is that a song that's like had meaning for you, maybe even at different parts of your life?
Absolutely. Different meaning. You know, I was born in the 50s. I'm a child of the 60s. So certainly I remember when the song came out, but it's grown to take on different meanings through the cycle of my life. I'm now in my 60s. So it's a bit more poignant for me than it was when it first came out. I think in the beginning, I was just caught up by the amazing lyrics of Paul Simon and the soaring, gorgeous vocals by Art Garfunkel.
Amanda, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And that there it is again. Somebody earlier mentioned Alexander. Timelessness, something that isn't just of its time. And this is a song for Amanda that can take on new and different meanings as she goes through her life.
And I think that's a song that is particularly well suited to that, because Bridge Over Troubled Water is a song about friendship. It's certainly going to apply to anyone who's thinking about a relationship, a romantic relationship, but it's also about friendship. It's about the people around you. It's about trying to help one another get up and get through. And that's something that you have to manage in every phase of your life, right? At every moment in your life, you have to think about how you're going to get to the next point, right? How you're going to get through the day. And that song has always provided that kind of comfort and reassurance to people. So it doesn't surprise me at all that it would fit into that kind of setting. God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, another example of a song that I think fits that kind of dynamic for people. So yeah, those songs that matter to people in their personal lives are really going to stick over time.
Amanda, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We're talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison, looking at the new Rolling Stone list of the 500 best songs of all time, updated from their 2004 list. Many, many changes. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Howdy. You know, I really love uplifting songs. So one of the songs that I was listening to a lot of rock and blues, and then I heard Van Morrison's Caravan on the Moondance album. And oh my goodness, what the beautiful production, the horns, the strings, the, in quotation marks, chick singers in the background. The chick singers happened to be Whitney Houston's mom and her aunt and another woman that were in the band and a group together. On that whole album, that's Whitney Houston's mom. And then also the Allman Brothers' Blue Sky with the gorgeous sound of the harmonizing Les Pauls. Oh, my goodness. And then the lyrics are so just a beautiful, soaring, uplifting music.
Mike, you sound uplifted just like talking and thinking about those songs.
Absolutely.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. We seek out, Alexander, a lot of different things in music. Uplift, certainly up there. Do you see a lot of this kind of uplifting music in this top 500?
It's certainly there. I mean, you know, Van Morrison is there. Into the Mystic is on there. And that kind of represents, you know, a big part of what he has represented to fans for a long time, which is this sense of transcendence, right? This kind of getting to a higher place through his music and through the feel that his music presents. You know, a song as straightforward as I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles, right? I mean, that's a song that just brings joy to people. Outkast's Hey Ya, which is in the top 10, another song that makes people happy, even though if you listen carefully to the lyrics of that one, it's not that happy, but it makes people happy to listen to it. So yeah, that sense of joy in the music is often what drives people to love music, right? It gives them an escape from whatever pain they might be feeling in the world. It gives them a sense of joy, entertainment, and of being able to experience something for a couple minutes that maybe gets you away from everything else going on in your ordinary life.
Thanks a lot for sharing those with us. We'll go to Liz now in La Crosse. Liz, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share the song All Too Well by Taylor Swift. I think she's really just someone who's really one of the greatest female artists of our generation, and she's come out with several new albums recently, and she's re-releasing the Red album that All Too Well is on. And I think she just poured so much heart and emotion into that song, and it's really one of my favorites of hers.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Liz. Taylor Swift appears on this Alexander. I don't think she was around for the 2004 or not showing up there. Can you talk about Taylor Swift in our last minute or so?
Well, All Too Well is on the list. It's in the top 100. It's her highest ranked song on the list. She has two, Blank Space is the other. And, you know, that song is just a powerhouse breakup song. And, you know, I think what makes Taylor Swift so much a part of the canon already and likely to become more of the canon on whenever the next list is, is that she's a very classic songwriter. I mean, she writes melodies and she writes songs from personal experience, but that often have kind of universal themes, and the lyrics are often adaptable to other people's experience. And so, you know, she's obviously caught the attention of an entire generation of listeners, and without any question, they've grown up with her and her music, and her music very self-consciously attempts to kind of gauge each of those eras and each of those phases of life. So, you know, when a song makes the list from Taylor Swift, it's not just about the one song, but what she represents for all of those fans.
Thanks for the call. Alexander, a moment you may have been dreading. Can you give us a couple of the songs on your top 10 list?
Well, I thought about that. If I had to come up with three or four that would vie for number one, I'll be honest with you, Aretha's Respect would be right up there. Mm-hmm. I think it was a really great choice at number one. The others I would think about are The Message by Grandmaster Flash and The Furious Five. If you're going to pick a hip hop song, I think that's the one that I would put at number one, although Public Enemy, no slouch either. And then the other two I would consider are Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry, because it's just so important historically, and Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Ooh. Brown, because it really transformed how soul and funk music would sound for decades beyond it. So those are the ones I would put right up near the top.
Love it. Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison looking at the greatest songs of all time. We'll go out with number 20 on the new Rolling Stone list, Robin and Dancing on My Own. This is Central Time. Coming up after the news, the host of the Hidden Brain radio show talks with us about the lies we tell ourselves and others and why they're not necessarily a bad thing. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, if it ever felt like your mind was playing tricks on you, you might have been right. While most of us like to think of ourselves as rational and truthful, our brains work in a way that sometimes can deceive us and others, on a daily basis even. Those lies can range from an interaction at the coffee shop to our romantic relationships, and oftentimes they can actually be helpful. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the way our brain works sometimes to deceive us? Have you noticed the role of self-deception in your own life or seen it on a bigger scale? Do you have a routine or ritual that you know doesn't actually do anything to make life better, the world better, but for some reason you do it and it helps you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Shankar Vedantam is the host of Hidden Brain, which airs Saturdays at 2 p.m. here on the Ideas Network. He's author of the book Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Shankar, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, I've had this thought, and you write that you have to, if we could just all be reasonable people and only work with the facts and the right stuff, we'd all get along and solve our problems. Not that simple, it turns out.
Yeah, not that simple. And we see lots of examples of it in our lives. Certainly in the news media, we've all had the experience of fact-checking a politician and sometimes coming up with, you know, thousands of corrections to things that a politician may have said and seeing that it has almost no impact whatsoever. The only people whom it convinces are the people who didn't like the politician to begin with, and the people who like the politician largely ignore what we say in the media. And that's a small example of a much larger phenomenon, which is that as we go through our lives, Rob, very often we look and see and hear and remember what it is we want to look and see and hear and remember.
Part of the problem is this, if it's a problem even, is this fundamental thing that our brain does. And this kind of blows my mind to think about it. When I look around the room here, I think I'm seeing everything and taking it all in. My brain is actually kind of finessing things to save processing power. What's going on there?
Yeah, so many of us think of our brains as functioning like a camera or a microphone or a filing cabinet, that our brains are basically taking in reality for what it is. But in fact, that's not the case. And if you thought about it for a moment, you'd realize why that couldn't be the case. There is so much going on around us all the time that, in fact, it would not be functional for us to actually see reality for what it is. The most practical and simple example I can give you is what happens as you look out through your eyes. You know, at any given moment, the human eye takes in about 1 billion bits of information. Only about 1 million bits of that, so reduced by a factor of 1,000, are sent to the brain. And the brain then discards most of that and keeps about 40 bits of information in any given moment. And so it's basically taking in 1 billion bits that come in through the eye, and the brain processes about 40 bits of that. The vast majority of what we see, what the eyes take in, are sort of essentially ignored by the brain altogether. And the reason for this, you could argue this is a delusion, but in fact it's functional because it helps us basically not take in things that would overwhelm us. And it also helps direct us to things that could actually be useful for us to pay attention to. So our memories, for example, of the past are not an accurate and complete recollection of everything that took place in the past. They're in many ways a selective recollection of things that took place, often with a view of guiding us, guiding our actions, behavior, and our thoughts in specific directions.
And at another level, our brains can deceive us. You give a lot of examples in the book of cases where our minds lead us to be maybe more optimistic about one thing compared to reality, or more pessimistic. Why would we evolve to have brains that want to kind of, you know, ease away from the truth from us from time to time?
Yeah, I'm glad you used the word evolution, because in so many ways, I think our brains are the product of evolution. And let me give you the simplest example that in some ways will make things really clear of why it is evolution has woven self-deception into the brain. And the example I want to give you is the issue of parenting. We've all known, those of us who are parents, but also those of us who have parents, which is all of us, how difficult it can be to raise children and how challenging it can be to raise children. And when parents think about their children, especially when a child is born, you know, most parents have the experience that I had, which is you imagine that your child, this baby who's born to you, is the most special child in the history of the universe, a miracle beyond all miracles. And of course, when you step back and look at it, you know that this possibly can't possibly be true. It cannot be the case that millions of parents, each of whom believe that their children is the most special child in the universe, it can't be that they're all correct. And yet this is a very useful delusion for us to have as parents. And you know, the answer is sort of blindingly obvious of why this is. Parenting is so hard, it's so difficult, it's so time consuming, it's so expensive, that it helps for parents to have delusional beliefs about the uniqueness and specialness of their children. And this, in fact, goes back long before humans arrived on the planet. Parents who had a cavalier attitude toward their children, those children would have been less likely to survive and pass on their genes. And so parents who selectively saw their children as unique and special and miraculous were more likely to invest the resources and time in raising those children. Those children, in turn, were more likely to pass on their genes to subsequent generations. And in turn, self-deception essentially becomes embedded in the brain. Now, I want to be careful. I'm not saying that self-deception is always a good thing. There are numerous cases you can point to that show how self-deception can be very dangerous and very troubling. The point that my book is trying to make is that we've in some ways ignored another side of the equation, which is all the ways in which the self-deceiving brain can be our friend.
Shankar Vedantam is with us talking about his latest book. It's called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. You can hear him on the Hidden Brain radio show Saturdays at 2 here on the Ideas Network. Join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, maybe an example for our guest of how our brains can delude us, for better or worse. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Well, one setting you focus in on at one point is healthcare. And of course, I think being a reasonable person, I want my doctor, nurse, whoever, to give me the straight story. Don't sugarcoat it, doc, except in many cases, you point out when it is sugarcoated, people have better outcomes or at least suffer less. How does that work?
Yeah, when most of us experience illness, it is not just the biological experience of illness that we're experiencing. We're also experiencing the psychological effects of what it means to be sick. Think back to the last time that you were sick, really felt sick. You know, you probably experienced feelings of loneliness and isolation and fear and anxiety and all of these psychological correlates of what it actually means to be sick. This is why when we turn to doctors for help, when we turn to the healthcare system for help, we're often not just turning to what they know as scientists and as experts. We're also turning to them as human beings. All of us have been to doctors who are very skilled and knowledgeable, but in fact are not very compassionate. And we find that we do not fare as well when we have those doctors. We gravitate towards doctors and nurses and physicians and other healthcare workers who extend compassion to us. There have been a wide variety of studies across many different domains of medicine that show that patients who have an optimistic view of their own conditions, their own disorders, their own diseases, their own disabilities, these patients tend to have better outcomes. Some of the studies have even shown that you might even live longer when you have a terminal illness if you have a positive outlook on your own situation. And again, this is not to say that we should trust every doctor or that they cannot be con men and swindlers and cheaters in medicine who basically lead us astray with fake cures. All of that is absolutely possible. But it is to say that I think when we all fall sick, we are right to seek out the insights and lessons of science. We are right to seek out the best hospitals, the best doctors, the best experts. But we're also right to seek out, in some ways, comfort and care, the things that our self-deceiving brain needs to make us feel whole once again.
And you mentioned fake cures, but a lot of times fake cures can really help. I mean, there's placebos, and I'm a big believer in placebos, but this blew me away. Placebo arthroscopic surgery for people with arthritis. Tell us that story, please.
Yeah, so the placebo has been known for a very long time to be a very powerful intervention. You know, there are many pharmaceutical industry studies testing new drugs where the trials essentially fail because people on the placebo arm of the study do as well as people who are receiving the actual drug. Now, when that happens, typically we think, okay, this drug is ineffective, it doesn't work. But really, it would be more accurate to say the effects of the drug are limited to the placebo effect, which is not zero. The effects of the placebo drug, the placebo arm, are usually not zero. We've typically thought of placebos in the context of medications. You know, you take a sugar pill, for example, when you have a placebo. But the placebo is not really just about a pill. It's really about all the things that a medical system can do to help you feel better. And in fact, there's some research that shows that even when it comes to placebos, the bigger and the more dramatic the placebo, the bigger and the more dramatic effect the placebo can have on you. And when you think about different interventions in medicine, you know, surgery might be the ultimate intervention, the ultimate, you know, medical intervention where it has a lot of drama and theater. You know, you're actually operated on in something called an operating theater. And there have been studies that have shown when it comes to disorders like arthroscopy, for example, there are surgical procedures that are widely used around the world. But some studies find that if you do fake surgeries, in other words, you're subjecting some people in the study to the real surgery and some people to the fake surgery, people who receive the fake surgery show tremendous improvement. Now, again, I want to be very clear. I'm not suggesting that all surgery is about the placebo effect. I'm not suggesting that real medications are not better than fake cures. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that in many ways, as a medical systems and as a healthcare systems, we often undercount and undervalue the importance of the psychological experience people are having when they're sick. And by underestimating this, we're removing from our quiver one of the most important interventions we have to help people recover and get better.
We're talking to Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain, about his book, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've heard a few examples of the way our brains can deceive us, sometimes for our own good. Have you ever noticed this at work in your own life? Do you have a question about how all of this works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time.
The eighth season of Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin offers plenty to get excited about. Host Angela Fitzgerald connects viewers with people whose passions, experiences, and expertise celebrate the best of Wisconsin. New episodes air 7 p.m. Thursdays on PBS Wisconsin. Episodes are also available to stream at pbswisconsin.org and on the free PBS video app, on streaming devices and smart TVs.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at WPR.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain, author of the book Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Oh, hi.
What did you want to ask about, Rebecca?
As I was listening, I was thinking, well, I wonder, are some people better at self-delusion than others? Are they happier than people who are not as good at self-delusion? And what about people who suffer from depression? Does that have anything to do with self-delusion? Are they worse at self-delusion?
Rebecca, great questions. I want to throw this to Shankar.
Yeah, those are really profound questions, Rebecca. People have actually struggled with these questions for many, many years. You know, initially, 30, 40 years ago, it was believed that people who were mentally healthy were seeing the world accurately, and people with mental disorders, especially disorders like depression or anxiety, were seeing the world with a delusional pessimism. But recent studies over the last 20 or 30 years have actually challenged that view, and they've challenged the view in a very surprising way, I think, because they've actually found that in many, many domains, people who have certain mental disorders, especially disorders like depression or anxiety, might in fact be seeing the world more accurately than people who are quote unquote mentally healthy. And this body of research has argued that seeing the world optimistically may in fact be part of what it means to be mentally healthy. So when someone is suffering from depression or anxiety, part of what you want to do is not so much tell them, here's what the world actually looks like, but to change their perspective on the world so that they start to see more of the upside. They start to see the glass as being more half full rather than half empty. And I think that's really a powerful way to sort of understand how the self-deceiving brain works, because it turns out that when it comes to mental health, seeing the world for exactly what it is might not be a prescription for the best mental health. In fact, all of us have been through a terrible pandemic for the last 12 months. All of us have probably experienced moments of great fear and worry. Some of us have actually lost loved ones. Maybe some of us have lost jobs. Many of us are worried about our health, our communities. Through all of this, we've all found various rituals and ways to keep us healthy, to keep us hopeful for the future. I know for my own part, every month of the past year, I've told myself that liberation was 30 days away. And the fact that I could imagine that liberation was 30 days away helped me in some ways, survive and cope with the difficulties of the past year. And you could say, well, it was clearly delusional to believe, you know, in April last year or May last year that the pandemic would be wrapped up in a month. And the answer might be yes, it may in fact have been a little delusional to have imagined that things would be wrapped up quickly. But in fact, it may have been a source of mental health to basically imagine that if all I had to do was hold on for a brief amount of time, things would be better. This speaks also to the idea that you see in many, you know, alcohol addiction recovery groups or people who are in prison for long periods of time. They often have the aphorism, you know, take it one day at a time. And the reason you take things one day at a time is not because taking things one day at a time means you're seeing reality more accurately than if you see, you know, the future 20 years at a time. It just as it becomes more manageable if you see your future one day at a time. So in some ways, it's a mental hack. It might be a delusion, but in fact, it might produce better outcomes and better mental health. That's a great question, Rebecca.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sharon from Appleton emailed to ask, could you please discuss this topic as it concerns religion? And I think you can, Shankar.
Yeah, so I think there's been a lot of study looking at sort of why it is that religions have evolved over the centuries. You know, there's hardly been any human culture over the last several thousand years that has not had religious beliefs. And certainly within the field of psychology, many people have tried to understand religion almost at the level of a really important social innovation. The religion in some ways came about to help societies of humans perform really, really complicated and difficult things that might not have been possible earlier. Some research has suggested that religions arose at a time when human societies went from being, you know, hunter-gatherer societies, you know, small isolated groups of 100 or 150 people, to much larger, you know, agrarian agriculture-based societies involving thousands of people. And the old rules of social contact where, you know, I knew everyone in my little group and I could evaluate whether they were trustworthy or not, those rules broke down as humans began to live in larger and larger groups. And religions arose partly as a way to solve problems of trust and communication and how to keep people in line and how to get people to act in terms of the common good. So from this point of view, the belief systems of religion, in fact, regardless of whether they are actually true or not, might in fact play a deeply functional role in many of our lives. Many people turn to religion at times of great difficulty. I know in my own family, I know many family members who are deeply religious who have become even more religious over the past 12 months because turning to a higher spirit, turning to a higher power has given them comfort in the course of the last 12 months, over the course of the pandemic. So from my point of view, from the point of view of the book, I would argue that religion is a really powerful social innovation. And the belief systems of religion, regardless of whether they are factually true or not, might in fact be playing an extremely potent role in keeping us healthy and happy.
And Shankar, in our last couple minutes, can we learn from the positive side of our self-deluding brain to help confront some of the harmful delusions that are out there, big, large-scale conspiracy theories, for example?
Yeah, so I think the model that I'm painting about the delusional brain is a model where the brain really is trying to mediate between an inside world and an outside world. And what I mean by that, Rob, is that we have a set of internal needs and fears and hopes and desires and an external set of reality that's coming in. And the brain is really mediating between these two things. It's playing arbitrage, if you will, between these two things. And when you understand delusions from this perspective, you understand that the reason the brain filters the outside world is because of our evolutionary history or because of the loyalties we have towards different groups. It does give us special insight into how you can dismantle dangerous delusions. Many of us are so upset by the content of dangerous delusions that we don't stop to ask, what are the psychological purposes this delusion is performing? And if we did, we might approach those delusions very differently. For one thing, we would be much more curious about them. We would ask the people who have the dangerous delusions a lot of questions. We would say, explain your delusion to me. Explain this belief system that you have. Explain how it works. And try and understand what would happen to this person if they were to give up this belief system. What are the losses that they would experience if they were to give up this belief system? I'm not suggesting that this would be an easy way to dismantle dangerous delusions, but I certainly think it would be a much more effective way to dismantle dangerous delusions than the approach that we take now, which is simply to confront dangerous delusions with factual counterclaims and basically say, your belief system can't be true because here are the set of peer-reviewed studies that I have against it.
Shankar, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Shankar Vedantam. He's host of Hidden Brain. You can hear him every Saturday at 2 p.m. on the Ideas Network. We've been talking with him about his book, his latest book, I should say. It's called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then from ancient plagues to COVID-19, our guest says there's a lot we can learn from history when it comes to dealing with infectious disease on a global scale. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.